Good morning. On today's programme, the effects on India's tourism after the US urges increased caution when visiting there. And green shoots and hope in Albania recently ranked Europe's poorest nation. But first to Canada, where there are concerns about Iranians linked to the regime in Tehran entering Canada. Three Iranians have been issued with deportation orders by Canadian authorities, while a fourth has already been removed. At least 20 more people have been flagged for deportation. Canada's Border Services Agency is investigating how dozens of Iranian officials have been allowed into the country. Dan Karpinchuk has this report.
In 2022, the Canadian government under former Prime Minister Justin Trudeau declared that Iranian leaders, including senior government and security officials, were not admissible to Canada because of the regime's involvement in terrorism and human rights violations. That decision was recently reaffirmed by the current Prime Minister Mark Carney at a Canada-EU summit. He said the state of Iran has been a sponsor of terrorism through Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Houthis, and more. And Canada has already listed the Iranian Revolutionary Guard as an active terrorist organization. Carney adds that these are all violations of international law. Not only does Ottawa deny access to the senior officials of the regime, but any member who arrived in Canada before or after the terrorism designation can be deported. As of early June, Canadian authorities looked at nearly 18,000 immigration applications from Iran that had possible links to the regime in Tehran. 131 visas were cancelled. Three received deportation orders for being senior officials of the regime. Other cases are ongoing and under investigation. An advocate for the Iranian-Canadian community, Kaveh Sharouz, says there must be more diligence by Canadian officials over who is allowed into Canada. Sharouz says there are people affiliated with the highest echelons of Iran's regime walking around, quote, our streets in Canada, and who pose a danger to Canadians and to the Iranian diaspora. He says the concern is that they are here monitoring the activities of Iranian Canadians and that they can be used to carry out acts of transnational repression. Data from the Canada Border Services Agency shows that at least 20 people linked to the regime are in Canada and have been flagged for deportation. One of them is Mahdi Nasri, a former hardliner who says he is now opposed to the regime. He's been in Canada for months despite the ban barring senior Iranian officials. Canadian security officials are facing calls from the public to find out why he was allowed to enter the country and if he should be deported. Nasri was well known for his role as managing director of the Iranian newspaper Kehan in the 1990s. Some have criticized the paper as an important tool in the regime's propaganda machine. The Border Services Agency would not say if it is looking into Nasri's case. But Mojdeh Shahiri, a refugee immigration and human rights lawyer based in Vancouver, suggests there is something wrong with the Canadian immigration system if it allowed Nasri to come to Canada with a valid visa. She says no Canadian should feel safe when there are people involved in crimes against humanity, terrorism, trafficking, and money laundering living amongst us as if it's normal. And she wants former members of the Revolutionary Guard found in Canada to be prosecuted, and for Ottawa to increase the investigations into what she says are the hundreds of people who have already settled in Canada with potential ties to the regime. And Kaveh Sharouz says it's infuriating to see people with past links to Tehran openly talking about the fact that they can come to this country. Canada does not have an embassy in Iran, but in an unusual move, Canada's Foreign Affairs Minister Anita Anand recently held an unprecedented call with her counterpart in Iran. She says she urged Tehran to allow Canadians to leave Iran safely after the recent Israeli and American attacks on the country's nuclear program facilities. Afterward, Anand told reporters that she's deeply concerned about foreign interference by Iran and the possibility of activating sleeper cells on Canadian soil. A former Canadian Justice Minister, Erwin Kotler, warned that Tehran could use these cells to commit acts of violence in Canada against Iran's critics. Kotler has been under police protection for his own safety after the Royal Canadian Mounted Police successfully prevented a plot by Iranian agents to assassinate him. A former Canadian national security analyst, Stephanie Carvin, says there is concern within the intelligence community that there may be Iranians affiliated with the Revolutionary Guard who could be living in Canada, perhaps with a cover story while working for the Iranian government. They could be involved in activities such as money transfers, espionage, repression, or sabotage campaigns against targets in Canada. She says they may not be sleeping, but they have been trained to engage in numerous activities. There are fears that more senior Iranian officials could flee their home country because of the conflict with Israel and look to Canada for a safe haven. Human rights lawyer Mojda Shahiri describes this as a slow-moving monster that will only speed up. For World Report, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
Next, the United States has warned its citizens to exercise increased caution when visiting India, provoking shock from the Indian government and plunging the tourism sector into uncertainty. The U.S. administration has cited India's law and order situation and the risk of rape and sexual violence to warn Americans against holidaying in India. Sajid Amoman reports.
A travel advisory by the United States cautioning its nationals to think many times before traveling to India has come as a shock to Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government and jolted India's tourism industry. Its concern is natural, as Americans account for nearly 20% of inbound international visitors. It is feared that many European countries would now take a cue from the United States and tell their citizens to avoid India. India is, in fact, squirming because the U.S. State Department has specifically warned women to steer clear of India, as rape has become one of the fastest-growing crimes in the world's most populous country, and sexual assaults have become a regular affair in many parts of India. As expected, New Delhi has officially questioned the U.S. advisory, insisting that it is not rooted in reality, but the outcome of prejudices and misconceptions about the world's largest democracy. Cut to the quick, many in India are claiming that the anti-India advisory is not reflective of ground realities, but the geopolitical rift between US and India, the world's oldest and largest democracies, respectively. A significant and vocal section of the government and hospitality industry sincerely believes that Washington is punishing India for openly contradicting U.S. President Donald Trump's repeated claims that he played peacemaker between India and Pakistan in the recent four-day armed conflict, pulling back the two nuclear-armed adversaries from the brink of a full-blown calamitous war. Completely ruling out Trump's role, Mr. Modi's government has made it abundantly clear that India's military might brought Pakistan to its knees and Islamabad begged for a ceasefire, which New Delhi agreed to. Stopping just short of calling Trump a liar, India insists that it opposes third-party mediation and believes in resolving all problems with Pakistan bilaterally. Pakistan, on the other hand, is enthusiastically backing Trump's claims and giving him full credit for single-handedly stopping the war in the nick of time. Pakistan has even nominated Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize for averting an all-out war. The Indian argument goes that while Trump has rewarded Pakistan by inviting its army chief, Asim Munir, to the White House for lunch for nominating him for the Nobel Peace Prize, the U.S. president is punishing India by stopping Americans from visiting the country to hurt India financially and spoil its global image. According to them, Trump's instructions to Apple CEO Tim Cook not to invest in India also stemmed from his anger over New Delhi and Prime Minister Modi steadfastly refusing to give him any credit for stopping the India-Pakistan conflict. They say that if Trump ultimately clamps huge tariffs on imports from India, as he has been threatening to do so for months, it will be purely on account of New Delhi not singing his tune and massaging his ego. What has hurt and angered Indians the most about the advisory is, no doubt, its projection of India as virtually the rape capital of the world, where women are not safe. Although the advisory flags several threats and challenges, its stress on sexual violence and advice to women travelers, especially if they are traveling solo, to be on their guard against predators in six specific states is unprecedented. Significantly, within a week of the controversial U.S. advisory, a French woman was raped in Udaipur in Rajasthan. The press in India does not downplay or black out news of sexual assaults on foreigners in towns and cities tourists flock to. Besides the risk of rape, the advisory also shines a torch on a number of touchy issues which the Indian government insists are internal matters that outsiders must desist from discussing or commenting on. Hence, strict directives not to travel to Manipur, the northeastern state witnessing ethnic cum religious violence, which has left 250 dead in 2 years, and Jammu and Kashmir, which is racked by terrorism and instability, have also not gone down well. If truth be told, the Indian government is even more embarrassed by the US advisory because the opposition Congress party is using it to attack the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party's governance record. The Congress party has warned Narendra Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party that unless it pulls up its socks, the country's image at the international level will get sullied even more. For World Report, I'm Sajida Momin in India.
Finally, to Albania, and the small Balkan country has long emerged from the Stalinist regime of Enver Hoxha, but it continues to face many challenges. Ranked by the IMF in 2023 as the poorest in Europe, its wages are low and young people are leaving in their droves. But in a country that once lived in extreme isolation, there are some signs of hope, as Pather King reports.
Skanderbeg Square in the heart of Tirana, Albania's capital city, where once stood the 10-metre bronze statue of former dictator Enver Hoxha, is a delight. In the warm glow of a summer's evening, I watch people of all ages stroll the 40,000 square metre plaza, paved with a mosaic of locally sourced, polished stone. Two old women, all in black, heads turned towards each other in deep conversation, stop right in front of me to light each other's cigarettes. Young people whiz by on scooters. Children crawl through climbing frames at the edge of the square. Life in Tirana, Albania. Public perceptions, however, can be deceptive. Behind the veneer of normalcy, this country is struggling. Young people are leaving in their droves. There is a massive brain drain. Human and environmental activist Valtiva Prendi, whom I met at a conference here, tells me the minimum wage is €460 a month. That works out at about €15 a day. Most people need three jobs to survive, she says. An irate taxi driver tells me that his mother must live on a pension of €148 a month. Rents are on the rise, and while inflation was down to 2.2% in May of this year, recent high levels have eaten into people's meagre wages. Everyone here I meet talks about what they perceive as political and judicial corruption. Last April, Tirana's mayor was jailed for corruption, money laundering, and crimes related to real estate and luxury travel. His co-accused wife is under house arrest, charges both strenuously deny. This in a country, along with neighbouring Kosovo, ranked by the International Monetary Fund in 2023 as the poorest in Europe. Taking time out from Skanderbeg Square, less than half an hour bus journey, takes me to the foothills of Mount Dajti. Here lies one of the 161,878 bunkers Enver Hoxha, Albania's sociopathic dictator, had constructed across the country between 1972 and 1983. This for a country with, at the time, a population of 1.1 million. Now a museum. The bunker is a five-story labyrinthine maze of corridors and rooms, all buried deep underground. For 40 years from its liberation from Nazi Germany in 1944 until his death in 1985, the notoriously paranoid dictator hermetically sealed off the country from all outside influences. Day and night, the territorial integrity of the People's Republic is fearlessly guarded in defence of our glorious socialist motherland. Hoxha is quoted in one of the opening exhibits. We build socialism with a pickaxe in one hand and the rifle in another, another exhibit declares. As if there was any doubt, another read, The border is closed to enemies, spies, hippie tourists, vagabonds, people with extravagant clothing, women with miniskirts and women with maxi skirts, men with long hair and men with sideburns. It did not stop people from trying to leave. 13,693 escaped across the border. 988 were killed trying. Those who remained were equally at risk. Between 1944 and 1991, 5,577 men and 450 women were executed. None of their bodies were returned to their families. International allies, once courted, were then discarded. First, Yugoslavia's Tito, then the Soviet Union, and finally China. Without allies, the country was alone in the world. Suffering from obesity and diabetes, and in a haze of cigarette smoke, Hotch's life ended in 1985 in his barricaded home, close to Skanderbeg Square. He never had to face the courts. His wife, who died in her 99th year, did not get off so lightly. She served 9 years in prison following the regime's collapse, but defended it to the very end of her life. For a country that once lived behind high walls, Valtile Prendi, my conference companion, sees signs of hope for Albania, citing a 2016 anti-corruption law and the high-profile jailing of the city's mayor. As for Valtile's own future, I want my children to stay in the same house as their grandfather. This is my community, my language. If I don't stay, who will stay? She says. This is home. This might be home for Valtiza, but one of her daughters has already left. This, it would appear, is the future of many of Albania's young. For World Report, this is Pather King in Tirana, Albania.
That's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Margaret Curley. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or on all podcast platforms. Back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Carol Coleman, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.